Yeah, we are so fortunate to welcome back. I'm going to call him a friend of the show, if I might. It's Dick Bowles, who is welcome back to the show with the 40th edition of What Color Is Your Parachute? A Practical Manual for Job Hunters and Career Changers. This is the 2012 edition. And just to name a few things in his life that I think even differentiate himself more from the field, he continues to give of himself all the time, and we know that from the show. He has in-home 5-day career workshops that he does quarterly in his house, and he's got a bachelor's degree, cum laude in physics from Harvard, and a master's degree from General Theological Seminary in New York City, and 3 honorary doctorates, and we are so proud to welcome him to the show and let him delight you with his insight in the career guru place that he is. So welcome to the show, Dick Bowles.
Thank you, optimist.
Wow, I don't think I've ever been called that.
We're delighted to have you back again, and happy anniversary.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You have one part in your book, Richard, that actually I have in my office. The quote, 100 years from now, it won't matter what kind of car you drove.
No, that's not in my book.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, it is. You tease me, and then you say, because you made a difference in the life of a child, and then that's why it was given to me, but I love where you said...
Well, that might be a quote I put in, yeah.
Right.
I was not the inventor of that sentence.
No, it's Dr. Forrest Whitcraft.
Yeah.
But I never thought about it. You also say... It doesn't make any difference, but you've made the world a better place for a child or an adult. And you talk about giving back and helping one-on-one, helping each other, which you do in, you know, millions. But you started one-on-one helping one person, and look where it has exploded to.
Yep. Life has very strange pathways.
And what would you recommend to people in job search if, you know, they're so concerned about getting the job? What would you recommend to people to help them think outside themselves and to get to that place, Richard?
Well, there are a number of recommendations. The first one is to look at what is within their control, because so everything we get hit with in the media day by day, 24/7, emphasizes how powerless we are, how we're up against vast economic forces, vast political paralysis, and so on, where there's no way on earth that we can make any dent in all that or change that in any way, and so we have to live with its consequences. But even if that's 95% of what we're dealing with when we're in job search, there still has got to be a 5% or so amount that's within our control. And for example, the first one would be to understand that employers hire in entirely different ways during hard times than they do when times are prosperous. I have a diagram in my book where it's an inverted triangle, and the top starts down the one side of the triangle saying this is how employers look for people they want to hire. And at the point at the bottom of the pyramid, it's again an inverted pyramid, you work your way up the right-hand side, and it says how job hunters like to look for work. And the key is that basically employers want to hire with the least risk to themselves, their budgets, and so on. And for job search people, their greatest consideration is what's the easiest, fastest way to hit as many multiple options or find as many multiple options as I possibly can. So at the top of the pyramid, employers prefer to start by boosting somebody from within their own organization. And the larger the organization, the more that is possible for them to do, because they've already seen that person at work. They know the quality of their work, and they know how good they are at their job. The next thing down is they can't hire from within. They try to turn to a colleague whose opinion they greatly respect and ask them for any, do you know of anybody who is good at blah, blah? And if they find such a person, again, their risk in hiring that person is relatively low because their colleague has seen that person at work. On the other hand, a job search person, an unemployed person, or a career changer is starting out trying to reach the most people possible, so they start with resumes. Mm-hmm. And that's at the very bottom of the pyramid. They start with the job postings that employers put up when they have a vacancy. And they look on the employer's own site if they know the names of specific places they would like to work, or the job hunter looks on the job board, such as Monster or Career Builder or even Craigslist. Now, the key is this. During hard times, now let's start with easy. During easy times, it's hard sometimes for the employers to find enough bodies or candidates, as they would call them, so they decide to humor job hunters. If job hunters like resumes, all right, they'll read the resumes. If job hunters like job postings, all right, they'll put up the job postings. However, when times turn hard and the employer doesn't have that much trouble finding a person for the position that's open, they default to their preferred position, and they go back to trying to hire from within or trying to hire from somebody they know who can vouch for the person. And the consequence of this is simple. During easy times, job hunters go with resumes and job postings, and that works because the employer has accommodated themselves to their preferred style, to the job hunter's preferred style. But when times turn hard, the employer has gone back to their default position, but the job hunter is still trying to find a job the way they did when times were easy. They're still sending out their resumes. They're still looking for job postings and getting no nibble from their resumes or getting no inkling of any job postings. They always reach the same false conclusion, which is there are no jobs out there. In fact, the government itself tells us how many jobs came that month, and it isn't the net statistic that is reported the first Friday of each month by the Labor Department. That's the net change in the total workforce. So if they say only 13 million jobs or whatever, 13,000 jobs were created this month, that's the net change. However, during the month, the government tells us what happened in a report they post called Job Openings and Labor Turnover. And it turns out in a typical month, this year, during the height of the recession or anything, there is between 6 and 7 million jobs that come up and become available, because there's about 137 million people plus in the workforce. And inevitably, they die, they retire, mm-hmm. they get sick, they move, and so on. So that larger workforce is always going to have vacancies. Well, if you understand just what I've said, you've gotten some control over your fate in this job market, because you understand you're going to have to change your method of job hunting from the position you like to do during easy times, because you understand it doesn't work. And that's what my book is about. It's about telling people where to put their energy, where things will repay them for the amount of time they invest in the activity. And I think that's what's essential for job search today.
So I'm looking at this 40th edition here of this book. I've got to imagine so much has changed. Obviously, we've gone through a lot of good times and a lot of bad times, and you've seen the different markets is where a lot of this information has come from. But I'm curious to just ask you, almost a little bit off topic here, just it's changed so much with the addition of social media and internet research that you can do. Do you think it's easier now to find a position from the candidate's perspective, or harder from where it was per your first edition? I'm curious to see the difference that
yeah,
you come across over all that time.
It's a good question, Paul. Here's the thing. Everything depends on the expectation that people have. So let's say a person has an expectation that if they go to one of these sites where they can post their resume, they'll go to bed that night, let's say Friday, and they'll wake up Monday morning and there will be a match. So the site they posted their resume on will send them an exact match. And I call this job hunting while you sleep. So So if the expectation of a person going to the internet is that with all the social media, with Facebook and with LinkedIn and all that, if their expectation is, oh, I won't have to work very hard at this because the internet will save me from all that, then they're going to find it's much, much harder to find a job now than it was when I first wrote the book, the first edition of the book back in 1970. It's harder now because their expectation is way too unrealistic. On the other hand, if they say, for example, I know I've got to change my method of job hunting when times are hard from the method I would use when times are easy. And they say, for one thing, I've got to not depend on resumes because employers aren't reading them and aren't paying that much attention to them when times are difficult. So I'm gonna try to get in to see employers of my choice. I'm going to choose places whether I know they have a vacancy or not. I'm going to try to find a bridge person. We used to call them contacts. A bridge person is somebody that knows them and knows you. So you want to get into work, say, for Bechtel Corporation in San Francisco. You try to find somebody that knows Bechtel, perhaps works there or recently worked there, and somebody that knows you. Now, in the old days, 30, 40 years ago, it was very hard to find that kind of a bridge person. Now we have LinkedIn, which has become, under Reid Hoffman's direction, more and more sophisticated. It's a site that's grown like Topsy, not in terms of its membership, but in terms of its cleverness. So if a person comes to the internet with that expectation, I'm going to do a different kind of job search, but I need help in finding bridge people because I'm not going to depend just on resumes to approach particular organizations, then they're going to find a job faster than they would have in 1970 because it's much easier to find those bridge people now because of the internet.
I mean, that's very, very true. You can reach people that you wouldn't be able to reach otherwise, and even research these companies as well. I mean, are there other sources or uses of the internet that you're seeing that can help the average job seeker?
Sure. They can do skill identification and so on. There's a guy who has a very interesting list of skills. I'm trying to think of his name, and I'm sure it'll come to me before I get any older.
Or we.
Yes, one of us. Anyway, I had him on my screen. He's in my book. He's on page 45 in the 2012 edition, which just came out. I finished writing
it. Mark Buckland?
Say that again?
Martin Buckland?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
I think the reference there makes you, you have to register before you can get his list of skills, but he has the longest list of possible skills, transferable skills that you might have that I've ever seen. So the other uses of the internet besides just job postings or being a place to post your resume is obviously that you can find the bridge people that I was mentioning much easier than you used to. You can find ways of doing a self-inventory that will help you greatly to describe to prospective employers exactly what your gifts are and what you have to offer to help their organization. There's all kinds of other uses of the internet, and it keeps expanding. In other words, each year you can look at the internet and say, oh, there's something else that they're doing to help the job hunter, and you'll be absolutely right. Google Plus, with its circles, for example, is going to probably prove to be very, very helpful to job hunters.
Mm-hmm.
Once they go broad. Right now you have to be invited to be on it, but it's going to be a force in the future, everyone's predicting.
Well, way back then when you first started, I'm sure there were lots of people that didn't know where to turn. And these days, there seems to be a whole lot more resources than
Correct.
There were.
Yeah, that's true, Felice. Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
So I have a two-part question for you. What do you say to someone that sees this book for the first time, whether they're a new graduate or they're the first time out after 20 years, you know, of having been somewhere? And what would you say to someone that's returning to this book? You know, not for maybe the, for the first time, either as a guide to using it or your thoughts for them?
Oh, it would vary with person to person, but probably I'd say don't, first-time users, don't just put the book under your pillow and hope to absorb the ideas by osmosis while you sleep. It will require some work on your part to read the book and to do some of the exercises in the paper and pencil exercises in the book.
Like the flower.
Exactly. I don't know whether you noticed this or not, but if you go to time.com this week, they have published a list of the 100 best nonfiction books written since Time was founded, which was 1923, and they put Parachute on that list this week.
Well, congratulations. Wow. We're not surprised.
I are.
Something new that you have in your book, Dick, is the pink pages.
I had those years ago, and oddly enough, they started out as yellow pages. My publisher, Phil Wood, didn't like them at all because he said it made the book look like it had weathered. The yellow looked like white pages that had turned yellow. So I said, okay, then let's go to pink.
Right.
And the reason for that is simple, and that is that there are certain essential truths that people need to know when they're out of work or when they're deciding to change what they've been doing with their life, or they're at some crisis like divorce or whatever. There's certain essentials they need to know, and I put those in the white pages of the central part of the book. But there's also stuff some readers need to know. So I created the pink pages as a way of putting in articles that were important but might not be of interest to every reader, so they could distinguish what they really do need to read, the white pages, and what they may or may not need to read, which are the pink pages. And this year, this edition, as you no doubt noted, I put in an article on how to deal with job hunting depression.
Right.
I wrote that article I wrote the basis of that article many, many years ago. And a dear friend of mine, Susan Joyce, who runs a wonderful site called job-hunt.org, she begged me to go and find the article, and I did, finally. It was in the archives somewhere, and I didn't like it. I thought it's outdated, so I rewrote the whole article. But the point I'm making is that I put that in the pink pages section and not in the main book, because not everyone necessarily gets into despair or falls into depression. But when they do, a certain type of reader who is in that situation is going to badly need some helpful advice, and that's what I tried to put there. So I love the pink pages, but they never were in the book when we first started out, because the book was only about 128 pages, and now it's just under 400. So it has grown like Topsy, and I've tried to, occasionally I just hack at the roots of the tree and I try to reduce the book by 100 pages or so, and then I get screams from the old readers, you know, the ones that have seen the book before. Why did you take out that?
So, you know, you indicate that in the back you have the section about depression that maybe not everyone needs, but you always include discussions about hope in the book. And it's such it radiates all the time with me every time I read your book. And can we talk a few minutes about hope for people in the job search and why it's important?
You're not, I assume I'm talking to Joy.
This is Felice.
Oh, this is Felice. I can't
But I'm full of joy.
You can't see us on camera one?
No, I've gone blind since I talked to you last. joy or hope is a crucial weapon in every unemployed person's armory or
arsenal.
Well, I was thinking more of an archer with a quiver on their back. Be one of the arrows in the quiver.
There you go.
Hope and is essential because it breeds energy. what is characteristic of the job hunt this year and during these last few years, compared to more prosperous times, is that it takes much longer to find a job, mm-hmm. much longer in most people's cases. And when I give talks around the country, I always ask people how long they've been unemployed, the people in the audience, and the number of hands that shoot up the longer I get out, from just 3 weeks or 2 months and so forth, the more hands go up. So if the job hunt in these hard times is going, maybe there's as many as 6 to 7 million vacancies that fall vacant and can be filled that month. But the important thing for people is to keep in mind, I forgot my thought. It was about hope, yeah. Energy. They need to have energy to go look for those jobs. They'll find them. There are jobs out there. My question to people is always, they say, well, you know, there's 15 million plus people out of work or underemployed, and you're saying there's maybe 6 or 7 million people who find jobs each month. That doesn't solve the social problem. What about the other 9 million? I agree with them. I say, yeah, it's a tremendous social problem, but it's not the same for job hunters. For job hunters, the question is, if there's 7 million people who find jobs this month, why weren't you among them?
Mm-hmm.
And they need energy. And energy is created by having hope. If you lose hope, it's easy to tell what happens. They did a study of 100 job hunters. I mean, for every 100, I don't know how many were in the actual study, but they concluded that for every 100 job hunters who only had one way to go about their job search, 51 of them gave up by the second month.
Oh, my goodness.
51 out of 100, more than half, gave up because they had no hope. You only use one method, and that method doesn't work for you. You don't have any fallback position.
Well,
on the other hand, they discovered that if they had two kinds of ways of looking for a job, there are 18. I enumerate them in the first chapter mm-hmm. of the new edition. If they have two methods of going about their job search, only 33 out of 100 stop and lose interest by the second month. So. Mm-hmm. There's a definite correlation between having the stick-to-itiveness and the energy to keep looking for those vacancies that do get created each month that you don't have if you've lost hope. You give up much too soon. You give up much too easily. I remember one time I had a workshop in Kansas City, and I needed to send the people out, so I needed maps of Kansas City, and I had about 90 people in my workshop, and I sent out two people to find maps, and they went to Standard Oil, and they went to the Chamber of Commerce, and so on. And finally, at 4 o'clock, they were husband and wife. The wife turned to the husband and said, "Well, dear, let's give up. At least we tried." And he said this wonderful thing back to her. He said, "In business, you're not paid for trying. You're paid for succeeding." And I always tell job hunters that. You don't get credit for trying to find a job. You get credit if you succeed in finding one. And that means you've got to have more than one way to go look for a job. You've got to have more than one way to describe what it is you have to offer to employers. You have to have more than one way of thinking how you're going to survive mm-hmm. if the method you're following now isn't working for you. Because hope is born when you have alternatives. And if you don't have anything but one way to go about something, it's very easy to lose hope if that doesn't work. But if you have a fallback position or positions, then you stay hopeful and you stay energetic because you're determined you're going to find it. You're not just going to try, you're going to succeed.
You know, and I'm baffled by that. 51 out of 100 give up. What do you do when you give up? I mean,
they come back eventually.
Okay. I'm like,
they come to one of your seminars.
Unless it turns out a rich uncle dies in the interim and leaves them his whole fortune.
Okay.
But,
So, Dick, please remind people how they can reach you and tweet you and read your blog and find you. And
you mean tweet me to a birthday cake?
Yeah.
always jokes. I find it very hard to be serious all the time. People used to knock my book. They said he's making too much fun. And I said, there's a fascinating film called Born to be Wild. It's in some IMAX theaters across the country now. And I learned a fascinating thing about elephants. Elephants have to be with other elephants. And, moreover, they have to be playing. They have to be happy or they do not survive. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what a wonderful metaphor for the human being.
Mm-hmm.
We should be more like elephants, not having an excellent memory, but dedicating ourselves to being with people and so on. So, to get a hold of me, first of all, my email address is very simple. It's all lowercase, no spaces. It's just DickBowles40. Now, the clinker is if people misspell my last name, so I'll spell this out. D-I-C-K, B as in boy, O-L-L-E, S as in Sam, at gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and
that's the thing. Then I'm on Twitter as Parachute Guy. Parachute is upper and lowercase, so is the word guy, and there's no space between them. And I have a blog, and moreover, I've redone my whole website. I haven't launched it yet. It's up, but nobody has access to it except me and God, right?
And maybe Marcy.
And Marcy.
Well,
my beloved wife is the angel of the earth to live with. So anyway, they can always email me and say, how else can I be in touch with you? And I'll be happy to answer. I answer all my own emails.
And before we let you go, we want to extend our sympathies for the loss of your sister as well as for your dear friend, Phil Wood. I know both of them were important.
Thank you very much for that. It's odd, you know, as you get older. I'm 84 now, as you all know, and I'll be 85 next March 19th, I think. And the older you get, the more you love life, the more you enjoy life because you've gotten wise about what's important and what's not. But the one sad thing is you find yourself living while all around you are passing on. And I've lost so many friends, so many dear friends over the years, and it's always a sadness for the survivors, namely us, who are left on earth. But I always think what a joy it is for them to enter into another world and another kingdom, which is what I believe, because I've always been a man of faith.
Well, we are glad that you are still with us, and we will love to have you come back with your next book.
Well, of course.
Don't stay away too long.
Yeah. What would it be, launch of the new edition of the book each year, if I couldn't come back and talk to you three?
Oh, thank you, Dick. Well, blessings on you, and enjoy life, and thank you so much for all that you do and give and who you are.
You're very welcome.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.